This is The Benson at 100, a podcast from the Nettie Lee Benson Latin American Collection at the University of Texas at Austin. The Benson is one of the world's most storied libraries. During this, our centennial year, we explore the people, archives, and collections that built this library. Learn more at benson100.org. That's benson100.org. Thanks for joining us.
Hello and welcome to the Benson 100 podcast. My name is Pilar Zazueta. I'm a historian and the associate director of Lilas Benson. As we have seen in previous episodes, the Benson is extremely strong in Mexico and Central America. But part of being the premier Latin American collection in the world means that you have to have strengths elsewhere too. Today, we'll be talking about the San Joao del Rey Mining Company's papers, which are held at the Benson. If you're having a hard time placing that organization's name, don't be discouraged. It is a British company that operated out of Belo Horizonte, Brazil, from 1830 to approximately 1957. Daniel, can you start us off with some information about first, the importance of this collection, and second, some background on the company?
Sure. Mining was central to the Latin American economies for three centuries and really reshaped global economics. I'm referring to silver in particular, but gold, diamonds, tin, copper, iron, and other minerals have also been very important to the history of the region and therefore the world economy. I'm talking about the development of economic systems based on getting minerals out of the ground, transporting them, and then using them as commodities or modes of exchange in commercial and financial markets. The Saint John del Rey or San Juan del Rey Mining Company's records and the collection at the Benson really shows this trajectory. And it was a joint stock company originally established in 1830. By a group of British investors, and their ultimate goal was to oversee a gold mine, which, as we'll talk about today, they do. This is approximately 8 years after Brazil declared its independence from Portugal, which really changed everything.
Yes, it changed everything. Suddenly, Brazil's economic interests were not tied to a vertical colonial relationship with Portugal. Brazil was not bankrolling Portugal's economy anymore, and they were open to business with different foreign investors.
It's worth pointing out that at this time, Brazil is still technically an empire under Dom Pedro I. And to further give us some historical context, Uruguay has won independence from Brazil in 1810 with the help of the British. Interestingly, this did not keep the British from pursuing their economic interests in Brazil.
You're right. We have to understand this investment within the context of the emergence of Great Britain as a world power. They are introducing railroads and new technologies in mining and maritime infrastructure, and of course, other things like sports, soccer, rugby throughout the Southern Cone.
Yeah, I've always seen this so clearly in Argentina and Chile. Of course, Borges' grandmother was British, and this is the second time I've managed to talk about Borges in throughout this podcast. But more generally speaking, the liberal political circles had an affinity towards Anglo-Saxon culture in the 19th century as well. We mentioned this with the Guatemala document in the previous podcast episode. There was this desire to emulate or imitate and incorporate British culture and thought into the national culture of these new countries. There was a similar process in Brazil, but part of the post-independence elites were very much influenced by the likes of Adam Smith and other thinkers and intellectuals, while the British were increasing their economic presence in the region.
Yes, exactly. The company leased the rights to work the San João del Rey mines in Minas Gerais, Brazil, from the mine's owners, who at the time were a German physician, and three British merchants. A team of Cornish miners traveled to Brazil to begin working the mines in June and July of 1830. The British had done this elsewhere, import workforce from their country. The same group of businessmen already had stakes in mining ventures in Colombia, Chile, and Mexico when they bought the rights in 1830 in the town of San Joao del Rey. However, within the first 2 years, the company shut down its operations due to low quality ore and legal issues.
And wasn't the mine flooded when the company's men showed up in Brazil?
That's right. It was worthless, but they continued to look for other options.
And the name Minas Gerais, or General Mines in English, that's not accidental.
No, definitely not. It's named, the state is named after the mineral riches that it has.
Exactly. And when we think of mines in Latin America, my mind goes to the silver mines in Mexico and Peru. But the truth is that Minas Gerais was famous since the late 1600s for its abundance of gold and diamonds. And gold, which is what we're focusing on today, stayed that way well into the 19th and 20th centuries.
Yes, after searching the region for available mining properties, the company purchased the Morro Belo gold mine in 1834. It had already been in use for up to 5 decades. It was an old mine, and that allowed them to stake their claim in the gold rush.
They acquired other mines too, such as the Espiritu Santo and Raposo's mines. But today we're talking about Morro Velho, which, to be clear, is the name of the mine that the St. John del Rey Mining Company owned. So you have the company and you have the mine.
Exactly. The company began their work by improving the mine's equipment and infrastructure. Although significant capital was devoted to high-tech renovations, the mine production increased rapidly, and the company paid out its first dividends in 1842.
So what sort of high-tech innovations are we talking about for the 1830s?
A lot of innovations. The company put in a dam in a nearby valley that they drew water from to operate machinery that could lift the ore to the surface. They were able to use water power to crush the ore and pump water out of the mine. They also utilized gunpowder and dynamite to bring down the rocks rather than picks, as it had been done in the past.
Well, it's a lot to think about and ties back to those other southern cone countries we were talking about and how the British changed the way certain things were done there. And similarly, and you spoke to this a little bit, the mining company encouraged the immigration of British citizens to Brazil to work in the mine. So we're not only having, you know, sort of a technological shift, but also to a certain extent, a population shift as well, a demographic shift, right? So the company also employed the labor of enslaved people who predominated in the workforce at the mine until emancipation, which for Brazil was in 1888.
Yes, we need to pause here and talk about the labor force of this mine in the 19th century. Here we have to give credit to historian Richard Graham, who has made the case that this archive helped us understand 19th century slavery, particularly from a global perspective. Brazil, along with the United States, was one of the major participants in the Atlantic slave trade. In addition to enslaving people to work in agricultural sectors, here we have a case of people of African descent being forced to work in the mines, which of course is an extremely dangerous place, not only in terms of physical danger, but also respiratory health as well. If that isn't bad enough, the mining company is making agreements that they're not upholding.
For example, in 1845, the company made an agreement with the Cata Branca Company to rent 385 slaves for a period of 14 years. And then once that 14-year period is complete, they would be emancipated. Well, that's not exactly what happened. When the term of 14 years was completed in 1859, the clause was quietly forgotten. So in fact, there's an 1879 report that showed that the company continued to enslave 200 people that should have been emancipated 20 years earlier. Just an atrocious abuse of power here. Soon after this, the Brazilian authorities freed the slaves under pressure from local abolitionists. And the case was actually one of the early events leading to full abolition of slavery in Brazil in 1888.
The company is making these agreements and not honoring them. And it appears that the federal government in Brazil is turning a blind eye to that fact. The company used force and coercion on their labor force because no one wanted to work in the horrible conditions of being underground and in darkness. St. John is not an unusual case. Mining in Latin America has a long history of using slave labor and repression. And to give you an idea, they had 1,600 slaves by 1867, a large portion of which were women. The company justified having female slaves in what at the time were considering quote-unquote men's jobs, saying that the women would cook and wash clothes for the men. But in reality, the women, did a lot of the manual labor in the mine itself.
Yeah, that's so true. And it was just a dangerous, terribly dangerous job. I mean, they had cave-ins in 1857 and 1867 that halted production each time for a year. For the 1867 cave-in, a fire broke out in the mine during the night, causing the mine to collapse. The company spent 7 years raising capital and working to rebuild the mine by digging new mine shafts.
The company had a number of scandals during its tenure, not just the ones that we have been talking about. In the 1870s, it was discovered that the then current mine superintendent, a man called James Gordon, was engaging in fraudulent business practices, including diversion of resources from the mine and participating in external business ventures. And this caused Gordon to be fired. The company had to find a new superintendent to restore order in the mine.
In 1884, George Chalmers was hired as superintendent. Chalmers began by reviewing and restructuring both the administration and the work processes of the Mortoveo mine. Before Chalmers was able to make improvements to the mine itself, though, a rock fall on November 10th, 1886 led to a gradual collapse of the entire mine over the next weeks, which we alluded to. 17 workers died. And as production halted and the company went into liquidation, Chalmers argued to reconstruct the mine via another new pair of mine shafts. Initially wary of the proposed depth of these new mine shafts, the board, directors, and stockholders were gradually persuaded of the plan, and Chalmers returned to Brazil in 1887 to restore Mortoveo. So just to be clear, his plan was to deepen the mine essentially for the new mine shafts, right? We're talking about a mine that was the deepest in the world at more than 8,000 feet. That's a mile and a half deep into the earth. That sounds so dark and claustrophobic to me that it's a travesty that a place like this could even exist.
But it existed because it made a lot of money. It was literally a gold mine.
Right.
So we use this as an idiom, and sometimes we don't think about the implications of running a gold mine. Even in the 1970s, it was still producing 5 tons of gold per year when the mine was basically tapped. And truthfully, and this is ironic, if the company had focused more on iron ore, it could have been even more lucrative. However, the directors back in London wanted gold. Who doesn't want gold? There's this obsession with gold, and this history of this company is part of it. The reconstruction of the mine began in the 1890s, and in addition to digging the new mine shaft that Daniel was talking about, Chalmers built several small hydroelectric plants to generate electricity for working the mine and taking out that gold.
As a result of Chalmers' efforts, gold production at Morro Velho exceeded previous records. So they're extracting more and more and more at a higher number. In the early 20th century, Chalmers also designed an innovative cooling plant to lower temperatures in the mine and secured land and resources near the mine for future use. Chalmers left his position as superintendent in 1924 after 40 years with the company and served as a consulting engineer until his death in 1928.
When the Brazilian populist leader Getúlio Vargas rose to power in the 1930s, the federal government of Brazil significantly changed labor and currency exchange practices for the St. John Mining Company. The formation of a miners' union at Morro Velho resulted in a more stable workforce with guaranteed benefits, while currency restrictions forced the company to reinvest in projects at the mine and in the area. There was a continued conflict between the primarily European supervisors and the Brazilian workers, which resulted in strikes and reduced production. And the infrastructure of Morro Velho was in need of renovation.
Finally, in 1957, the controlling interests of the company were bought out by a group of investors primarily interested in that iron ore that the St. John Mining Company had not prioritized. And this iron ore was something that was also occurring naturally in the area. The investors sold the company's iron lands to the Hanna Mining Company based in Cleveland, Ohio. And with that, the 130-year tenure of the St. John del Rey Mining Company came to an end. Or did it?
Yes, you're right. This is not the end of the story, and this isn't a nice and neat ending. You mentioned the Hanna Mining Company in Cleveland. It also was sold to a South African gold mining company that continues to operate the mine today, making it one of the oldest continuously operated mines in the world. So this is incredible. But let's go back to the collection of the St. John Mining Company and some of the items that are contained in the archive that is housed at the Benson Library here at UT.
For sure. So it's a massive collection made up of correspondence between companies, cablegrams, reports from meetings, mine inspection reports, annual reports, meeting minutes, financial records, legal documents, employee records, printed materials, and something we'll talk about in just a few moments, photographs. But essentially, you know, anything you would need to run a multinational company for like 120 years, that's all being represented in this collection. The Benson acquired it in the 1970s due to a collaboration between the famous Nettie Lee Benson, William Callahan, a UT doctoral student who inventoried the materials in London, and Professor John W.F. Dools, who was a trained mining engineer with a background in Mexican mines. Also of note, he was the son of John Foster Dools, the Secretary of State, who was quite a relevant historical figure in the early Cold War period. So, you know, we're talking about a very well-connected and powerful family. For the purpose of this conversation, we're focusing on the son, John W. F. Dools, who prior to becoming a professor at UT, was actually an officer in the Brazilian part of the Hanna Enterprise, that Cleveland company. This facilitated the discussion to move the records from London to Austin.
Yeah, so the history of how UT acquired the collection and the people involved in getting the collection to Texas is also very interesting. But beyond that, it is an important collection because it spans so many years and different periods, right, Daniel?
That's right.
I would also say that's our most important Brazilian collection as of this moment. But more than that, it makes a significant contribution to the study of the African diaspora in Brazil, and we can't overstate that enough.
Totally. And today we have a few photographs that we're looking at that we're going to attempt to post on the site. They're all from 1892 to 1894, which is about 60 years after the company purchased the Morro Velho mine. What jumps out to you about these photographs?
Really, more than anything, the sudden contrast between nature and machinery. Other photographs from this period reveal a largely agricultural area, and in these photos we see the imposition of technologies that we're discussing into a landscape that wasn't really used to it.
Yeah, that's spot on. I think, you know, the photo that sticks out to me the most is this one with a pipeline that essentially, it kind of looks like some sort of monstrosity that's being inserted into the area. I mean, it's huge. It's like cutting it, you know, it kind of looks like it's cutting into the earth in a way.
And that's exactly what it was doing. And it's sort of a testament of the historical period of this interest in digging out reaches from the earth and what it does to the environment and the place where this is happening. And sure, the mining company was among Brazil's largest taxpayers, but you have this foreign company run by the British that is rapidly transforming the Brazilian countryside through the creation of a company town in order to extract precious metals and minerals for their financial benefit. Meanwhile, Brazil's people are being exploited as labor, and the landscape is cleared out to make way for this technology, and then all of these technologies are going elsewhere. They're being exported.
Right, the commodities.
Yes, the commodities.
Yeah. Exactly. And we know that generally speaking, mining contributes to all sorts of environmental problems. You have erosion, sinkholes, deforestation, loss of biodiversity, significant use of water resources. One of the photos shows like the damming of waters. We talked about this a little bit too. Wastewater disposal issues, acid mine drainage, and then contamination of soil, contamination of ground and surface water. All of this can lead to serious health issues in local populations. And that's what, you know, there's so much of this collection that makes it important and significant. We talked about the African diaspora here. That's a main piece to this collection. But I also think another significant aspect to it is this engagement with environmental and social change related to extractivism, right? And many researchers in different disciplines are working on the topic, and they're working on it from different perspectives because it continues to be relevant for the economies and societies of most Latin American countries, actually. So that leads me to a question for you.
Fire away. What's your question?
what do you think the legacy of the St. John del Rey Mining Company is? You know, how are people remembering it, or how will they in the future?
The human and ecological cost of mining have been too high, in my opinion. And in general terms, these enterprises have not offered many tangible economic benefits in terms of well-being to most people in Latin America. So the St. John mine is an interesting case study because it was an enclave in an overwhelmingly agricultural economy. The word enclave here is central because it connotes isolation, physical and political. In other words, the location of the mine was indeed remote, and the strategy of the company was one of self-reliance and being disconnected from the national economy and the national politics of Brazil. Historian Marshall Eakin, who wrote a book about the company, explains that it did very little to stimulate regional industrialization, the mine and the company. He also notes that it was quite vulnerable to government pressure. This is at least in comparison with other mining operations and even commodity producers such as United Fruit in Central America or the henequen and fiber producers in the Yucatan Peninsula and, of course, the oil companies in all of the continent. In other words, this particular gold mine is not an example of a foreign firm that was politically powerful or as politically powerful as it was economically profitable.
Yeah, those are great points as always. And as we're wrapping up, I'll say that I learned a lot about this collection by doing this podcast with you. And we covered 150 years in like, I don't know, 40 minutes. That's not bad.
No, not bad at all. So let's end it here. Thank you for joining us today as we discuss the St. John del Rey Mining Company records at the Benson. And until next time, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Benson at 100 is a production of Lilas Benson Latin American Studies and Collections at the University of Texas at Austin. To see relevant images and links for today's discussion, as well as to support the Benson Centennial, visit benson100.org. Music for this podcast was composed by Ola Ola. Thanks for tuning in.